One F Jeff, the legend of the bar, spitting truth raw, no facade. Waste the sword, slice him through the floor, breaking down the noise like a wrecking squad. Jeff's in the zone where the real ones roam. Podcast throne, make the doubters moan. Words ain't harder than a granite stone. One F Jeff, cleaning the crowd alone. Jeff's in the zone where the real ones roam.
This is the eighth episode of One F Jeff.
The number eight is considered lucky in many Asian cultures, especially Chinese, because it sounds like the word for prosperity. It's also the atomic number of oxygen and represents infinity when turned on its side.
Today's guest is Danny Akins.
Bai Fu Liang Hoa Danny Akins.
El invitado de hoy es Danny Akins.
Gestur Duxens er Danny Akins.
I think one of the first times I met Danny was at a New Year's party at his house in 2023, I think. I'd been invited by some friends of mine who knew him through his wife. It was a fun party. If I recall, I was a bit drunk, if I recall. A few of us were tired, and I think there was actually a snowstorm going on, so we wanted to leave early. So we did the New Year's countdown at like 10:30. It was funny. I think it might have been my idea, actually.
Danny Akins is a former Army major who led over 300 combat missions during the Iraq War. After leaving the military, he transitioned into civilian life and now works with the Ohio Department of Veterans Services.
Danny's one of those surprising people who on paper is somebody that I wouldn't necessarily get along with. But once I got to know him, I realized my assumptions about him were wrong. There's plenty of stereotypes about military people. You all know what they are. But Danny defies those stereotypes in a way that makes me question all the stereotypes that we use to categorize people without really getting to know them. At some point, it was probably a survival mechanism of some sort, this quick categorization of people and probably animals and so forth. But all it seems to be doing now is slowly tearing the country apart. So maybe we should all try and stop doing that and have more conversations. Conversations like the one that follows, which made me rethink a lot of my preconceived ideas about what the military is and who enlists and so forth. I hope it does the same for you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being here. Here's Danny.
I left work early today.
That's good.
Yeah, that was nice.
What'd you do with your time?
Not a damn thing.
Oh, well, that's also good.
Yeah.
I
fall into that trap too much, but...
Don't we all?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Danny Akins, thanks for coming.
Thank you for inviting me, Jeff.
Appreciate you coming in. We met through, I guess, friends from poker, right?
From poker and my wife, Sarah, her friends are your friends.
Right,
and because
Brad
I married. So I married into the friend group, sort of.
Right. Did you grow up here?
I grew up outside of the city in West Jefferson, just west of Columbus in Madison County.
So been here your whole life?
Except for 4 years in college and 4 years in the Army.
Where'd you go to school?
Miami University down there at Oxford.
All right.
The original Miami, as we always say.
And what'd you get your degree in?
Political science.
Oh, all right. That makes sense.
Yeah. It was great. I will say I had a great... some great mentors, some great professors. It was the first place I really, I was probably one of the few people in my high school that was politically interested, read news all the time. So it was interesting to go to college and then all of a sudden be around other people that were just as interested in those things.
Right.
And that was, it was broadening.
Mm-hmm. So what was the plan, political science? What'd you plan to do with that?
Well, it's interesting. So originally I wanted to be an astronaut, and then I took algebra in high school and realized that would never happen. So
there is a lot of math involved.
There's a lot of math.
You don't realize that when you're a kid.
Yeah, like, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I was always interested though in, international relations, foreign policy.
Okay.
My uncle got me into reading Tom Clancy books at a pretty early age. I read Hunt for Red October, I think, when I was 10.
And you think that was like the origin of your interest in?
Very much.
Okay.
And of course, by 1990, the movie Red October comes out, and
right.
Jack Ryan.
Good movie.
Alec Baldwin was brilliant in it.
Sean Connery.
very much I was kind of like, oh, I want to be that guy one day, maybe not jumping on submarines and stuff, but you know, that kind of person.
Right.
So originally I was studied, through my studies, studied international relations, national security, comparative security studies, Soviet politics, back in those days.
And you were thinking you wanted to go into like international relations or?
Yeah. And actually I took the foreign service exam, towards the end of my senior year, and I took the written exam in Ohio, and then was invited to the orals in DC. And while I was at the orals, that's kind of a whole day. And by the time I got done with the afternoon, I was kind of think that this is also in the context of the Bosnian War.
Right.
And so my impression of the State Department was the organization a little bit that had allowed the massacre at Srebrenica to occur.
Right.
And I was a little skeptical of what they were, but that's kind of why I wanted to do it. I was like, oh, you know, I think I can come in, make a difference, go places, do
things.
Fix it. Yeah. Like you do when you
make the government less evil.
Yeah. But I was pretty disaffected by the experience. So I came back to Columbus. I graduated that December of 98. And I had been doing a summer internship with the state of Ohio as a human resources policy intern.
Okay.
Completely opposite of international relations.
Right.
But it gave me the opportunity. It was in an office on policy development, human resource policy, but still policy development. Mm-hmm. So it gave me an opportunity to understand how Ohio's revised code works, how the administrative code, which implements the law, works, how those rules are changed, how legislation works, how the relationship between state agencies, the governor's office, the legislature. It gave me an opportunity to see all those systems at work.
Right.
And so when I finally graduated Miami, they offered me a full-time job as a HR policy analyst.
Weird tangent here, but so one of my first jobs out of college was working at a place called Thompson West, and we edited the Ohio Revised Code.
Yeah.
It was the most boring job I've ever had in my entire fucking life.
Did you guys bound them? Into
no,
like a
we
book?
Just edited oh. the copy, and then somebody else bound them. You haven't really edited until you've edited the boring text of the Ohio Revised Code.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Anyway, good times.
Yeah, absolutely.
Made me realize I should never be a lawyer because that was, yeah. At what point did you go into the military? I'm curious.
It was 9/11.
That's right.
I was working downtown. Guy next door to me, he just happened to listen to Howard Stern.
That's how I found out.
And so everyone kind of starts hovering around his cube the mm-hmm. way people did. And I remember one thing that I think young people today don't appreciate is I kept trying to pull up news sites all day.
Right.
New York Times, Washington Post, CNN. Right. Couldn't pull them up
right.
because too it much didn't. Bandwidth.
Right.
I had a friend that lived in DC. I had, you know, the old flip, you know, first model phones or whatever. Couldn't get a hold of anybody in DC. Couldn't get a hold of a friend in New York.
Right.
Lines are jammed or whatever. Finally, I pulled up the Toronto Globe and Mail and it popped up right away. And that was the first picture I saw where they had, you know, the first tower being hit.
Well, at first they thought it was just a small plane.
Correct.
Right.
And I remember when that picture popped up, I was like, that's not a small plane. That was a large plane.
Yeah.
That was at least some form of jet.
Unless the World Trade Center is much smaller right, exactly. than it is. Yeah.
Correct.
Right.
Obviously, as the day goes by, it doesn't take long. Not even an hour later, the second plane hits.
Yeah, something like that.
And so when that occurred, back then, the state of Ohio still did civil service testing, mm-hmm. literally written tests.
Okay.
And they would do classes on the floor above us. And I knew they had the good old-fashioned TV on the roller mm-hmm. cart. And so I went up there. They were in the middle of class. I literally just walked in. Took the TV. I was like, sorry, we got to have this. Take the TV back downstairs. We got it to a side of the floor with the rabbit ear so we could try to tune in
right.
a news station. And so we finally, you know, everyone just watching and, you know, the whole day unfolding. One of the gentlemen I worked with who since passed away was a guy named Paul. He was a Navy veteran
okay.
who had served on the blockade line during the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis.
Oh, wow.
Already there, he was talking about his time in the Navy in the 60s. And of course, I come from a family of veterans. And so the whole day, this kind of thought started percolating with me. I remember they finally evacuate downtown. I don't get on a bus. I just walk since I live in German Village. I remember the oddest thing being is no one talked, even though the traffic was jammed. No, there were no horns.
Right.
And that's how, you know, as a young person, you kind of, all right, this is very different. Like no one's got the answers today.
It's actually funny because I was working at the editing the law books you were using at the same day, right? I was working in the Thompson West when and listening to Howard Stern in my cubicle, and they rolled the TV into the you know the meeting room and everything, and everybody just kind of stopped working. And I remember like the second plane definitely made it more serious, but then I remember when the first building collapsed, that was when it was like, fuck, dude. Yeah, that was a day.
It sure was.
Yeah.
So I get home and house is empty. I walk up to planks at Whittier and High because I just don't want to be in the house alone watching sure. the news. My roommates at the time worked at the Sam Goody in the mall, the okay. music store.
Right.
And so I finally get a chance to call them and say, hey, are they evacuating you guys? And like, yeah, I think they're going to eventually, like everybody's closing down all the stores.
Right.
So they end up joining me there at Planks and we just spent the whole day there. And everyone kind of watching the news, people talking to each other. Older guys at the bar getting angry about all the Arabs they were going to kill one day.
Yeah, great.
And I remember having a moment where I told the guys, I was like, hey, I know this sounds silly, but I think I'm going to join the military. Like, mm-hmm. this looks like war. And so I think...
How are you feeling? What were your emotions about?
I will say what's interesting, it wasn't something that was motivated by the let's go kill the bastards
right.
stuff.
Right.
You know, I grew up around veterans. My okay. dad was a veteran. Two of his brothers were veterans.
Okay.
His brother-in-law was a veteran.
Wow.
All of those guys had served either in Vietnam or in the seas off Vietnam back okay. in the 60s. And so the veteran experience wasn't one that was strange to me. And I remember thinking that this was kind of like, okay, this is like a generational moment
mm-hmm.
that people our age, early 20s, the people already in the military, that type of thing, would be the ones that this is going to fall on, and that we have this one opportunity to get a job done, ideally so that no one has to after us. You know, that's the thing we always kind of kid ourselves
with. How naive we all were.
Well, and what's interesting about it, we always kind of fool ourselves, right? I'm sure that's what they thought in World War One. 20 years later, World War II.
Sure, but yeah.
They fight World right. War II.
We're going to end war.
Literally 6 years later, Korea.
Right.
Literally right. 10 years later, Vietnam.
Well, the military, and Eisenhower was right, so.
Yeah.
The military industrial complex is literally a thing.
It so is,
absolutely. Got to keep fighting somebody.
Absolutely. So I didn't make any decisions that evening. So interestingly enough, September 12th is actually my dad's birthday. Our kind of little tradition from me coming back from college and stuff like that, we would go out on the deck, smoke a cigar, which mom hated, and we'd have a beer. And this time I said, hey, dad, don't tell mom. And I said, I think I'm going to enlist. And dad, he goes, well.
Was he in the military?
He was. He was in the army. The only thing dad said, and what I appreciate about it, dad didn't try to like, talk me out of it.
You sure.
know, that kind of stuff. It was more of a, okay, well. Before you do, I want you to talk to our family friend, Mike, because Mike was a Green Beret in Vietnam, and he had gone to officer candidate school. And so my dad thought that since I had been in college that I should think about becoming an officer.
Okay.
So me, dad, and Mike, a couple weeks later, you know, just have dinner and talked about it and convinced me. Of course, Mike wanted me to go OCS, Infantry Airborne Special Forces, just like he did. I was thinking, well, I don't know if I want to do the whole special forces
right,
thing,
right,
but,
right.
you know, we'll figure out a combat arm here somewhere.
Right.
And so the day we started bombing Afghanistan was the day I called the recruiter and said, and I had it all kind of set out. I had kind of wrote down what I was going to say. I want to enlist. I'm a college graduate. I'd like to go to officer candidate school. I'd like to become an army officer. I'd like to do combat arms, either tanks, field artillery, or maybe even infantry. And that's what started the process.
I wonder how many people did the same thing after 9/11. I wonder if there was like there had to be an uptick, but I wonder.
There was. So back in April, went to my 20-year army unit reunion for our Iraq deployment. And it was a good reminder of all the guys that, you know, especially some of my fellow platoon leaders that were same thing as I was. They enlisted in the army after 9/11. They were doing whatever they were doing. And I remember being at basic training
right.
that summer of 2002. And the first real batches of people that ran to the recruiting centers were coming through.
Okay.
And there were at least almost 20 guys who were going to officer candidate school, all of whom already had college degrees.
Right.
All were already, you know, 23, 24 years old. And interestingly enough, to a man, were all political science majors.
Huh.
Every last one of them.
Huh.
And I remember we all thought that was kind of a funny, like the civically minded, engaged types.
Not, it's not really what you expect in the military.
Yeah. And so the other thing that happened on 9/12 was all those people who had gotten their commissions, not all, but a good amount of people who had gotten their commissions maybe like earlier in the late 90s and stuff like that, they had reached their 3-4 years of their active duty requirement. And on 9/12, they put in their paperwork.
Sure.
So there was a bit of a dip in the officers of certain ranks in years. And so because of that, there was a big push to get people to join and become officers and stuff like that, because obviously they were going to be expanding units and things like that. That followed us all through, at least for most of us, through our early Army careers. We all got promoted to captain faster. Got promoted to major faster.
And is there like, there's like a money bump for that?
Oh, yeah. Every time you go up in a pay grade or it. And so you'll hear people say like, O1 is second lieutenant.
Okay.
O2 is first lieutenant. That's lieutenant's the rank. O1, O2 is the pay grade.
Random question, but like what kind of cash are we talking about? What kind of money did you make back in the day in the Army?
Most people enlist, they come in at what's called E1, enlisted one. And they don't make a ton of money. They make good money for someone who's 18 years old.
Right.
Who is getting their housing paid for, their healthcare paid for, their food paid for.
Yeah.
Most of their uniforms generally paid for. They actually do charge you for your uniform.
Do they really?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's crazy. But, so they, how many uniforms would one missile, I mean, it's like insane, right? You could buy the fucking uniforms.
Yeah. The Army would essentially issue you 4 regular battle dress uniforms, and there'd be a portion of your check would be deducted. Probably not the full value of it, but just
I wonder how much.
A little bit.
Interesting. Yeah. So were you scared?
I was nervous about failing. That's the only thing I was ever really scared of.
Right.
Before you ship out, you're scared of the unknown. What's it going to be like when the drill sergeants all start yelling at us and we get off that bus and all that. But I remember thinking at the time, it's just so intense, and it's that you just kind of, it sucks early, right? You're going to have all the emotions like I made a bad mistake. Mm-hmm. This was stupid. I could be back home with my buddies just hanging out. But even within just that 9 weeks of basic training, within a week or two, you begin to really get conditioned into the hours. I mean, you're going to be tired as heck, and you'd be literally so sore and tired, you'd be looking for pebbles and rocks that you could reasonably trip and break your ankle on.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like that's because you're just,
right.
It does kind of push you. And that's why, you know, anybody who's, the reason especially other folks who served have a lot of respect for those who did is just getting through basic training is an accomplishment.
Right.
And
what was the hardest part of that?
Understanding how to get past what you thought your limits were.
Okay.
In terms of the amount of sleep you don't need necessarily.
Right.
The physical part of it, obviously, because you run everywhere. You're always walking. I was at Fort Sill, Oklahoma in the summer. It's a roaster. And I remember thinking that I started to enjoy it, oddly enough. I can remember doing a road march, you know, full rucksacks, rifles, whole nine yards. And I can remember looking down at the shadow of me and the sun and thinking to myself like, oh, that's kind of cool. Like that's me holding that rifle and doing this thing that my dad did, my uncles did.
Right.
Here I am doing it.
So then basic training, where do you go after that?
After that, went to officer candidate school at Fort Benning. That is an entirely different animal. Physically challenging, but also becomes more mentally challenging because now they're trying to take you from this gruff, you know, enlisted soldier and turn you into someone who has to be responsible for other soldiers.
Like a manager.
Yes. That's where I had my hospital stay, got bit by a spider.
Oh.
And so.
What kind of spider?
Probably a brown recluse.
Oof.
Got cellulitis real bad in my right arm. Twice a day, guy would come in my room and check the swelling. And he'd be like, if that line catches up with that line, we're cutting the arm off.
Oof. That's a fun game.
Yes. So, but get through officer candidate school, get your commission.
Okay.
That was a proud moment.
was it 8 weeks of basic training and then how many weeks of officer training?
I want to say officer training was about 15, 16 weeks.
So what was his like, what, probably early 2022 at this point?
Yeah, so I enlisted in 22 by the time.
2002.
By the time I graduated, it was early 2003. Okay. I want to say around February, March.
And then when do you get your like deployment orders or whatever?
Well, then you still got to go to your school for your branch. So I was Army, but while I was there, I got assigned to tanks.
Okay.
And so then you have to go to armor or basically tank school and learn how to be a tank platoon leader.
That actually seems fun.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. It was a lot of fun. So even as a lieutenant, we had to learn how to drive, load, shoot, and command a tank. Mm-hmm. And then we had to learn how to command a platoon of tanks, four tanks. And so that was all kind of interesting. And while we were at armor school was when Iraq kicked off.
Okay.
And so I remember we even had CNN.
Got to get those weapons of mass destruction they were hiding. Those tubes.
All those WMDs.
The tubes.
Yeah. And I remember, you know, what's interesting about it too. I remember having discussions with my fellow lieutenants there. And I got to be honest, none of us were really buying the WMD thing.
I don't think anybody was.
We thought that it was a cover because we thought strategically, the only reason you go into Iraq is so that you can occupy the country, eliminate Saddam, and put bases on the border so you can then invade Iran.
Sure. Yeah,
so we in our own mind thinking, oh, we're missing the big show in Iraq. We comforted ourselves with the idea, oh, we'll be the first into Tehran, right? We're thinking this is going to be just one after another, right? I mean, we've already identified the axis of evil by this time.
Right.
So we're like, we'll be the Iran
guys. We're
going
to go get the entire Middle East.
We're just going to remake. It's going to be just George Washington
the Middle
from
East.
Here to here. Yeah. It'll be the Washington Crescent, not the Fertile Crescent. It was like school. Like you stayed in bachelor officer's quarters and your job is to go to classes, sometimes a simulator. Sometimes you go out for the week and you shoot tanks.
Sweet.
That's pretty fun.
Are there, keys to a tank or just...
There's key to locks to the hatches, and that's about it. Like once you get in, it's just a push button.
Nobody's like, "Where's the keys?"
We have to oh my god,
the keys to the tank. So how long does the tank training last?
That was like another 14 weeks.
Okay,
and then that was completed about I want to say the spring of 2003, and then got my orders to go to Fort Riley, Kansas. Got assigned to the 2nd Battalion, 34th Armor. They're part of the 1st Brigade, 1st Infantry Division. And but you have an opportunity for leave as well. I took a couple weeks off, actually almost a month off that summer, got married and Columbus.
Wait, how did you meet the woman? You had it before?
Interestingly enough, she was someone that I knew before I enlisted. She was someone I was dating here in town.
Oh, all right. And she stayed with you and then?
We had originally planned to kind of break up. Like she had always wanted to live out west. She had a friend in Arizona and our original plan was I ship out for basic training. She moves out to Arizona.
Right.
And if we see each other down the trail, great. If not, I'm going to war. I will tell you, I always had in my mind that I thought I'd probably get killed in it. Right. I had that almost from the very beginning. I had this sense that I wasn't going to survive this thing somehow.
Oh,
as it was, as I got to basic, she started writing me letters. I started getting letters from her.
Right.
And from those letters at basic training is kind of where
that's very romantic.
Yeah. That's just it. Like, it turns out though, that was the illusion because we didn't get along great, even when we were just dating.
Right. But it's more romantic and you're a long way away. Yeah. And
and that's why I've always said the secret to my first marriage was that, I mean, I was in the Army for 4 years.
Right.
During that time, her and I were probably in the same house, maybe 11 months.
It makes you think about like the soldiers that came back from World War II. Like my mom was born when my grandfather was at war. Like my grandfather didn't even meet my mom for a year or two after she was born because he was crazy.
And the thing is like, we were a great military couple. We get to Fort Riley and she comes with, right?
Right.
You know, we get family housing and it's a different kind of world, right? Because you live with other officers. They put your name with your rank. They give you a little thing so you know exactly Colonel so-and-so lives there, Lieutenant so-and-so. That way you also kind of know like who your neighbor is. So when you're all wearing civilian clothes, you don't go, "Hey, asshole." No, that's Colonel so-and-so.
That's Colonel asshole to you.
And you never quite hang it up, right? You're always who you are on base.
Right. What was the general mindset you kind of got from the people that you met there? Or was there no real general mindset? It was so much like a variety.
Interestingly enough, mindsets were different on main post, like when you were home.
Okay.
Like after you're done with the duty day versus being at work. So whenever we were done for the day, you go home and you take off the uniform. Most guys, most men and women, plenty of women there as well, would take the uniform off almost right away.
Sure.
The idea is that you're making this transition.
Yeah.
And then it's more of a, no matter what your rank is, obviously you're respectful, but it's casual. So like I'm living right next door to a lieutenant colonel. He's literally four pay grades above me. Right. But at night it's Danny. I'll still call him sir, even though he insists on me calling him Dave or whatever.
Right.
And throughout the year, there's always going to be other families in the neighborhood that their husbands or wives are deployed. Mm-hmm. So you're spending some time keeping an eye on them.
Oh, it's like a nice community.
Yeah. You're visiting them. You know, you're bringing over food. One, I wasn't great about calling home. I didn't call home a lot because there were some guys that would call home frequently. I wasn't a big fan of that because I was like, what if she doesn't hear from me? She's going to wonder.
Right.
And I was convinced I was going to get killed again. I was still in the mode of
interesting.
Because that's what I thought allowed me to function as a combat leader was assume you're already dead. And that way I don't spend a lot of time being worried about if I peek around this corner, if I go run up the street that I'm going to get killed.
Huh. That's a very interesting way of going through. I mean, I imagine a lot of people go through it that way.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's the, for me, I it's the best way to go through it because then I'm thinking about the mission. I'm thinking about my men. I was always worried about my guys.
Right.
I was never worried about myself
because
I was like, if I get killed, I'll be the last person to know. Like if this,
sure.
if I walk up on this to see if it's a bomb, if it is a bomb, they'll know about it.
Right.
I won't.
Right.
Because I'll be
fast and easy.
I'll just be spread all over the desert there. It'll be someone else's job to clean me up. So,
right.
And eventually I get a tank platoon. Great platoon.
And how many guys is that?
16 guys,
okay,
four per tank.
Right.
So one platoon leader, a platoon sergeant, two section sergeants that are staff sergeants, and then all your soldiers.
How fast do those things go?
On a hard top road, which you don't have too often.
Sure, but you know.
You could probably maintain about 55, 60 for a short amount of time.
Wow.
You're going to burn up a lot of gas.
Sure.
Overland, you could get it up to 30, 40 miles an hour.
Wow, that's pretty easy. Kind of amazing.
There's also a reason why we always invade Middle Eastern countries in the wintertime. It's because M1 tanks run hot. The exhaust, it's basically a jet engine. It's a runs on JP-8 jet fuel. It's a turbine engine. And the temperature of the air right outside the exhaust is 900 degrees.
Wow. So then you finally do get deployed.
We get deployed, get to Kuwait first.
Oh, okay.
And your job there is to kind of get everybody into one place, and then you kind of form the brigade, as it were.
Had you been overseas before this?
Never. I never actually traveled overseas.
Wow. And so you're like, what, 28, 27, 28?
Yeah, by this time I was 28 years old.
Right. And now you're in the middle of the fucking Middle East in Kuwait.
We're in
where's your head at this point?
You're just ready to do it. Like you're kind of nervous. You've been studying what the units that have gone before you.
Right.
You try to learn a little bit from what they've learned. Right.
And what's going on?
But you never really know until you see it on the ground.
And you're staying at there's a military base in Tents. Kuwait.
Yeah. Big. Right. It was called Camp Buring. It was what the Army calls RSOI, reception, staging, onward movement, and integration.
And it's just a tent you're sleeping in. It's got to be hot.
It's a giant base. Well, fortunately, it was January of 05.
Oh, right.
And so it would get down to like maybe the high 30s,
right,
low
desert,
40s at night. It's their rainy season, so it'd be kind of wet. So it was kind of, but you know, even in February, I remember towards the end there before we got into Iraq, while we were there, it started to get, you know, pretty warm.
So when do you head to Iraq?
I think it was early. It was like the first week of February.
And what was going on in Iraq at this point?
Just before we got there, they had a provisional election.
Okay.
To elect a provisional government.
That was the thumbprint one.
That was the very first one.
Right.
The very first one. Now, we knew that part of our mission there for the period we were going to be there, that there was going to be a constitutional referendum. And then there would be a election based on that constitution. So a lot of what we had trained for was about securing the area to prepare for those elections.
Right.
And I can tell you that our perception of it was we're pacifying, we're creating security conditions so that they can have these elections and that these elections will be it. We'll be we'll be in place a little bit longer. There'll be smaller units replacing us. What started to pop up during our year was the beginning of the Sunni-Shia civil war.
Okay.
And it was a deliberate attempt by the Sunnis, the old regime people then leveraging religious differences.
Always.
And that's why, you know, it wasn't about religion. It wasn't about doctrine or anything. It was about people leveraging religion for power.
Right. Well, this is the story of...
Yeah. And so we started to see like they would provoke people by blowing up Shia shrines and things like that. And because we couldn't be everywhere, you know, you couldn't just stop it all.
Right.
And at the same time, we're trying to help build an Iraqi security force, new police forces, new army forces.
Right.
So that they could, you know, secure their own country.
So when you first get to Iraq, you go to the base there, I imagine, whatever it is.
Yeah, we fell in on the base. The units that we're replacing are already there.
Okay.
And I actually got to meet with the guys that owned our sector. And I went out with them every day. I'd go out with their platoon leaders, their sergeants. I'd go out on patrols with them. I was taking notes. There was all the stuff we had learned. Then there were the tactics, techniques, and procedures of the guys on the ground. By the time my guys did come up, the rest of the company comes up, the rest of the battalion. I then did a presentation for my company and the other platoon leaders and platoon sergeants on, okay, this is how...
This is what's actually going
on. This is how we do it out here.
Was there anything that was just like, oh, this is not what I expected?
I thought the locals would be a lot more hostile to us. One of our responsibilities was manning what we called a joint coordination center. Guys in our company, we would take our platoons out. We'd man this joint coordination center in a town called Khan Bani Saad. Probably about 100,000 people or so. We'd have 13 soldiers, 14 soldiers living right in the middle of town.
And your role for that was to do what, too?
We would conduct some patrols, especially early on. I'd be, later on, the Army told us to stop doing this. I would kick out 2 vehicles and 6 men. Or we might do a quick foot patrol.
Being amongst the people and seeing what's going on with
walking
the people.
Walking around. And, you know,
was it PR, kind of, to a degree?
A little bit of that. A little bit of like, hey, we're not just monsters. We're here. Right. Like, we're present. We're... You got to remember, though, too, Iraq was a country that was pretty used to having its security forces around.
Sure, it was already.
And so there was a deference to authority. One of the things we noted sometimes was that if we held up a rifle to try to, you know, at a checkpoint or a hand to try to stop people, it didn't work a lot. But if you pulled a pistol out, it'd stop on a dime.
Huh.
Because Saddam's guys always used to, they always thought if you pulled out a pistol that someone was dying.
Oh, all right. Because Saddam.
Yeah, because that's what Saddam's guys would do. When I would meet with like an Iraqi civic leader or a sheikh or something, neither of us wants us there.
Sure.
But we're trying to be practical about the fact that we want to secure the population. We want to get the water running. We want to get the electricity going.
Right.
We want to secure elections.
Right.
The one thing that did kind of help some of my cynicism towards the end of our deployment were the elections. Because I did see people that really did want to vote.
Of course.
We would drive down the road days after elections and people would hold their pink purple fingers up to
us. Yeah, I remember the video. I remember the news. Yeah.
They don't have to do that. We're not telling they want to show us because they actually got like
we're trying.
We're far from home.
Yeah.
We're here for that. And that's what I used to tell my guys too. We're here to show the people who live here. We're not here to kick in their doors all the time. We're not here to put guns in their faces. We're here to show them what the security forces of a free country look like, how they operate, how they respect property, how they respect individual rights, how we don't just tie people up for nothing. When we first got there, it was still kind of early on, and there was a lot of what we call kinetic operations, kicking in doors and things like that.
Right.
We very early on transitioned from that, which we thought was overwrought, too much based on intelligence that was, you know, a guy pissed at his neighbor. So he says to the Americans, there's guns there.
Right.
So the Americans go in and be like, oh, there's no guns here.
Yeah. And you're taking a huge risk in terms of just turning off the population.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. So we started doing what we called cordon and knock, where we'd cordon off a neighborhood to make sure people can't just drive in like car bombs and shit. But then instead of like kicking in the doors, we would knock on doors.
Ring the doorbell.
You know? And we would always take Iraqi security forces, and we try to put them up front as much as possible.
Uh-huh. It's fascinating to me on the level of like your job is to basically interact with people that we in America have been told to fear, number one, right? That are the enemy. But you're getting to see how they live. You're becoming, I would assume, friends with some of them and go
live see with them. Some of them.
Oh, right.
I mean, when we'd be at patrol base, my guys were in a barracks right alongside Iraqi soldiers and Iraqi police.
And you have interpreters, or they speak English?
We'd have interpreters. I'd always have my interpreter stay with our soldiers in the barracks so that they could communicate with the Iraqis.
And are you ever just like shooting the shit?
Yeah. No. I mean, I got to know Colonel Abbas. He was the sheikh leader of the Al-Amari tribe in that region, Shia.
Okay.
He had been an Air Force pilot in Saddam's Air Force.
Huh.
Because of that, he had money, right? And so he owned a lot, and he had land.
Right.
He had a couple of wives. But he dressed like a Westerner. He wore suits and ties.
Okay. When you're shooting the shit with him, talking about family, whatever.
Yeah. He would always say, Lieutenant Akins, you need wife Iraqi, you need to meet my daughter.
Right.
And we have no doubt, like, obviously these women are beautiful. Like,
sure.
Yep. And, but it's like, oh no, I don't think wife American would be all thrilled if I came home with wife Iraqi. And he goes, ah, but you live here with her. Then you go back America with wife American. It all be good. It'll be good. And it's like, no, I don't think that's how it works, brother. But you do get to know him. And I happen to know that Colonel Abbas was killed the year after we left.
Oh.
And it shook a lot of us because we got to know him really well. And he was a respected leader and he died doing what he does. He
right.
was, helping out his community and got, you know, just demolished by a car bomb. And you did get to know, like, you'd see the same kids,
right?
Because we're in the neighborhood. You'd see the same kids all the time.
Yeah,
you'd
yeah.
see the same chicken vendors.
Yeah.
We used to work with the Iraqis that worked in the coordination center that we had. And some of the men that worked there, their wives would make dinner or lunch and they'd bring it in.
Hmm.
I'd have dinner with them.
A lot of like pita, hummus, that kind of thing.
A lot of that. Every once in a while, there were a couple of things I drew the line at. I was able to use the excuse of my seafood allergy to not eat the fish they got right out of the probably relatively polluted river.
Oh, right.
There was one guy, his wife would bring meals all the time. What I was told was she used to love to hear that the Americans ate it.
Oh, well, I mean, how would you not? Of course.
That would be her highlight, right. apparently.
Right.
And look, I remember... God bless our Iraqi army friends. They just never were very good. They didn't go through a lot of training. It was kind of just taking local kids and throwing them out there and they give them uniforms and boots and guns.
Right, right.
Not a lot of training. And they had a bad habit of falling asleep on the checkpoints. There'd be checkpoints on every side of town.
Right.
And they'd get slaughtered. And I remember there was a 12-year-old kid at the one checkpoint that got chewed up. And he used to run, his dad had him running a little snack shop. And now it was probably there even before the checkpoint was there, but the checkpoint gave him even, you know, people stop, you sell them ice cream and candy and all that shit. Yeah. And the bad guys who had come in and chewed up the checkpoint, you know, a little flying column with trucks and stuff like that. They'd even gone to the bother of finding the kid hovering behind his freezer and killed him, like shot him right in the head. And, you know, we knew that kid, you know, he would try to sell us ice cream. We'd never buy it. When we would go out there, I would buy like ice cream for the soldiers at the checkpoint
kind of thing.
You know, it really bothered you to see people you knew getting chewed up and you're like, this is their home.
Do you remember the first time you were out there and you saw a dead person?
Oh yeah. It didn't take long. There was a car bomb and the unit I was with kind of went out to it and saw all the charred bodies in the vehicles and the people that have been killed around it.
What's that experience like?
It's one of those where I will say I never did have like the movie rookie moment where
you can be prepared for an experience like that because you know you're going to experience it, but like actually having it, it's got to be, I mean, I would think
the most bracing thing, and I think the thing that always stays with you the rest of your life is just the smell. The smell of a charred body, the smell of people's insides. It's a stink.
When was the first time you actually saw action?
The first time where it was like, oh, this is real. I remember coming back from an early patrol. I want to say it was in my mind. It's March 3rd, 2005. We're coming back one of the side road, you know, one of the, what we call the bypass roads along the main route. And my lead vehicle goes and blam, the road explodes.
Huh.
And you immediately start doing what we call 5, 10, 20, because you're looking for the secondary.
Yep.
First one goes off. One thing they got good at was having an ID go off here. They begin to watch our doctrine. We stop about, you know, 100 meters short. Well, you start planning secondary IDs where you know the Americans are going to stop.
Stop. Yeah.
And so what you would do is you look out your window. You don't see any turned up dirt, any IDs. So you get out and then you look at 10. And before you move, you look out at 20. To make sure there's nothing else. And then you begin trying to secure the site.
How far were you from the car that got blown up?
Well, they missed the vehicle. So we try to keep about a 50 meter interval, 50 to 100.
Mm-hmm.
So it blew up between vehicles.
Okay.
You would always be on the lookout for things like turned over trash, lamp posts, things people would use as aiming points.
Right.
Right. Right. And they just weren't very good at it. Now, as the war evolved, even
so there's
that
somebody hiding somewhere.
Yeah, with either a wire command detonated or a remote.
Okay.
Detonated. The first time that we really had a firefight, that was several months in. And I actually had an Air Force combat camera crew with us. We were actually doing a company raid on a identified target. We had planned it the night before. We were going to have the Iraqi security forces with us. So it was two things. It was a targeted raid, but then also a training opportunity for the Iraqi army. And what ends up happening in that is we clear one village, nothing too serious. And then all of a sudden in this one palm grove, shooting starts. And the shooting starts, we have a couple of Apaches flying air support for us. And someone fired a RPG at it, rocket propelled grenade.
Jesus.
Now, the trick is, like, when you fire one of those, the pilot can see exactly where you fired it from.
Sure.
So we begin to then...
So they missed.
They missed, okay. Yeah. Now, what that did cause, though, is obviously once that happened, whatever we were doing all over here, that all changed. We pack everybody up, move over here, cordon off this wooded area, and now we're going to kind of slowly try to advance into the wooded area. And you try to get Humvees in as far as you can because you got armor and machine guns on them.
Uh-huh.
And then at some point, you know, you'll have to dismount. Now, what ends up happening is we got into a certain point. My lead vehicle stops because he's at a spot where he's got a kind of a built up mound in front of him. And there's a house just to my right. And like this gravel road, access road just kind of stops. So I start to dismount, get out of my Humvee and start getting on the ground to kind of see what's what. And all of a sudden, ton of shooting over our heads. Now, it felt like it was way over my head.
Right.
So I initially react and I go down to a knee because I still want to be able to try to identify it. Like, I'm the lieutenant. I've got to figure out what's going where. So far, I don't see anything. I just can hear bullets. And it's...
How many people are you thinking?
Could be 5 or 6.
Okay.
Maybe 10 at most.
Right.
Now, I think I've got pretty good protection. So even though I'm not right next to cover, I've got that mound out in front of me. But I noticed that when I knelt down, the bullets got a little bit closer.
Mm.
So then I laid down flat on the dirt. And I'm halfway between my Humvee and my company commander's Humvee. And all of a sudden I look to my right and the bullets are skipping off the dirt. And I was like, oh, I'm in a bad spot.
Yeah.
So I kind of get up and I'm trying to also stay calm. So I kind of range walk very quickly over to my commander, be like, hey, sir, we've got to either pull out of this or I want to get a group of these Iraqis. I want to get them on top of that house. And I want to see if we can see what's, you know, who's shooting at us.
So is it like bing, bang? Bang, or is it like bang, 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 bang?
This one started out with very much everybody shooting us at once. It felt like an ambush. And so...
Is it like the first time you actually like were legitimately scared?
I wasn't scared, actually, because you go into this thing. You want to preserve yourself, but not for the sake of self-preservation. You want to preserve yourself so you can lead your unit. You literally want to find where they are and just stop it.
Right.
And it's kind of funny how everything takes over. Like you're... peripherals go away. Everything's just right here.
Right.
And that's where eventually, God bless, we get to a point and I have this Iraqi army unit with me. And I tell the Iraqi lieutenant, I was like, I want you to take your unit on top of that house and then report back to me, send a runner to tell me what you see so that we can decide how we're going to assault this thing.
Well, and they're still shooting.
At this point, they had stopped shooting for a little bit because my guy had kind of suppressed them a little bit with the machine gun.
Okay.
Now, instead of running behind our position, which is kind of what I want him to do, he just runs straight for the house and ends up getting a few guys cut down because they see that and they start shooting again and they kill a couple of his guys.
Of your guys?
No, Iraqis.
Iraqis, okay.
And so I run out, get one guy, we get everybody pulled out. By that time, I get our battalion commander has called down to my company commander who's calling me and saying, hey, just got word. They've pretty well identified from the air that this is all insurgents. So they're going to pull all the Americans out of the wood line and the choppers are going to come in and they're just going to rocket the shit out of this thing. And so we go up, we try to recover the casualties. We get out to the main road. There's a cinder block wall because everybody's got a wall around their house.
Mm-hmm.
And that provides us a defilade of safety. So we know we're good. And we administer first aid to the wounded one. There's ambulances out there already.
Oh, they were Iraqi soldiers that were working with you that got shot.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. All
right. I was confused.
And that's where they get there's a picture of me that became relatively, you know, unit famous after helping to dress one of the soldiers' wounds in his hands. I'm holding his hand.
Oh.
It ended up on the cover of the U.S. Forces newspaper in Iraq.
Oh, cool.
Later that month.
Do you still have it?
I do. I actually have it framed at the house.
Oh, right.
People kept giving me copies of it. And of course, it was propaganda gold, right, for the army.
Absolutely.
Like an American lieutenant holding
a
lieutenant, Iraqi lieutenant's hand.
Right.
you know, during a joint operation that successfully killed so many insurgents and got all these weapons and stuff like that. In that moment where we grabbed him and I got his ass out of there, he wasn't just an Iraqi soldier. He was just one of us, right? He's just another soldier on my side. And, you know, we got him back to get him, you know, so that the medic could work on him.
What was the worst action you saw out there? What was the worst?
The two worst things I saw was that probably that checkpoint massacre I told you about. I remember that was really something because by the time we got to the checkpoint, we got a chance to take a few pot shots, but they were well away and we had to secure the site. And there's just 15, 16 dead.
Right. And Iraqi that was pretty early on too.
Yeah. And I, you know, the guy in the tower had been obliterated. I remember going into the tower and of course there's a ladder inside that goes to the top and the inside was just a bunch of human effluents pouring down the side.
Oh God.
And I had to get up there. So I pushed the lid and of course the dude's on top of it.
Oh Jesus.
And the other one was we're at that same coordination center. Regular day, then all of a sudden we like mortars start falling around town, clearly randomly fired, probably from the back of a pickup truck and probably from the other side of this town was surrounded by canals. They clearly were shooting at us and the Iraqi army base because they do land a couple.
Sure.
One doesn't even explode, thankfully. And then of course, once they start moving and the mortar gets out of place, they just start landing all over town, right? Because they're just, you know. And so once I get my guys secure, and it's not like I've got a bunch of guys. I've got like 12, 13 guys. We're like, all right, here's where I think they came from. Go down, get six guys. I drive up to the Iraqi army base. I'm like, hey, this is where we think the point of origin is. Let's at least get over there, see if we can track somebody down. I want you to go this way. We'll go this way, and we'll try to see if we can cut them off from the only road that goes out.
Yeah.
So to get there, we have to go over this canal on that side of the city. And that's the only road that goes over this canal. I only have two vehicles. There's two Iraqi pickup trucks in front of me. And the second one has the lieutenant. And of course, these are packed to the gills with Iraqi soldiers, little yellow Toyotas. And somehow they managed to jam like eight people in them.
Like a clown car.
And an IED goes off right next to that canal bridge. And it obliterates that truck right in front of me. And I remember watching the dudes in the back go from being human beings to basically just red dust.
Wow.
And it was on the side of the vehicle so that the lieutenant who had been on the right side in the passenger seat, I stop, I get out, and without securing that, I just run right to his truck. And he is just covered in the three dudes that were sitting to his left. And he is angry. Obviously, as you might imagine,
right?
He's in shock. He's angry. And my translator is telling me,
Lieutenant, he's very angry. He says he wants his unit to clear out all these houses and kill everybody. And I was like, well, that is not going to happen.
Right.
Like whoever these guys are, it's the guys that launched the mortars. It's not here.
Right.
So those are probably two of the worst things. You know, there'd be car bombs. You'd come up on a site. I remember being asked on quick reaction force for the battalion one time where you're the dedicated like 911 group. And like you'd see, you know, bodies in cars and, you know, they'd blow things up in a market and they wouldn't get any Iraqi soldiers or Americans. It was just all civilians.
Did you ever kill anybody?
Yeah. Yeah. Had an opportunity to do that.
What does that mean?
There's only one guy that I know for sure that I drew my M68 red dot sight on and dropped him.
Okay.
Everything else was kind of.
Maybe I hit somebody. Maybe I didn't.
Maybe we hit somebody. Right.
And how was, I mean, did that shake you up at all? Or did you just like, no, think that was part of the job?
We ended up landing on a crew that was trying to prep an IED sight. They were being kind of brazen. They were digging a hole in broad daylight and we just happened to be passing by. And so my lead vehicle reports back to me, says, hey, I think I've got guys on the side of the road digging. I'm like, oh, okay, well, go up, speed up and try to detain him. Car takes off. He takes off after the car, shoots it up with a machine gun. The two other guys, they see that Humvee, so they run the opposite way, which just happens to be right at me. And so between me and my gunner, we took those two guys down.
War is such a strange thing if you really break it down, because these are just people thinking they're doing the right thing. mm-hmm. right? You're people that think that you're doing the right thing, and it's just
you. I never hated him. I got to be honest, I was never angry at anybody for trying to kill me.
Because nobody, everybody's just doing their quote unquote job, and like everybody's got It's just such an interesting dynamic, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like you think back to what was it, World War One, where they the Christmas Eve or whatever when they all got together and hung
soccer
out.
Matches and
right
stuff like that, right. Yeah. Which they stopped, obviously, after that, because
God forbid
they were like, oh, you can't start seeing the enemy as a human being.
I mean, I guess that's true in a way. I mean, that would make it harder if you just played soccer with somebody to start. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you're in Iraq. We won the war, of course. And then
we were there for the stability and support operations.
Mission accomplished. Yeah. Mission accomplished.
We were in the Middle East for literally 365 days. We arrived in Kuwait in 19 January. 2005, I think by New Year's, we had moved back down to the base in Kuwait for getting everybody set before you take the plane back. And by the time when we left Kuwait, it was 19 January 2006, literally 365 days.
It's so strange because you were basically in Iraq when I was in South Korea teaching English.
That's it, yeah.
Like the parallels in our life are kind of interesting because the law book thing, number one.
Yeah.
And then like, you know, I don't know, just strange, right?
Yeah, we were on the same continent.
Right. Weird.
Well, it's interesting you say that too, because obviously the year before, if in 2004, if North Korea would have invaded South Korea, there would have been only two active duty battalions or ready to reinforce us and the other battalion on Fort Riley.
But that was a big, there was a lot of, because I was near, but Incheon, and that was where the big military base, I think Yongsan
were. Yeah.
And there were a lot of people there.
Well, so traditionally, there's always been about 38,000 U.S. troops. Right. It's essentially a tripwire. It's to ensure that U.S. forces get killed on the first day. That way we're bought in. That's literally why the force is there. It's a confidence measure for the South Koreans. Because if we're not up there, there's always a question like, hey, if none of our guys get hit, do we really support them or not?
Yeah. Were you deployed anywhere else after?
No, after that, we got back to Fort Riley. You always do like a 30-day, what they call like a block leave. Mm-hmm. And so everybody got 30 days off.
Right.
And
what do you do with your 30 days off?
One of the things I had done before I left was get my passport done and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Because I told Margo, I said, my wife at the time, I said, if I survive this, I want to go to Ireland. And so literally before I ever came home, I remember I got home into Kansas. Margo was there at the hangar, you know, plane lands, bus takes us to the base, everybody, you know, the family moment. Like I can show you pictures sometime from that moment. You're not looking at a thrilled human being. I was terrified because I knew I was going to be getting out within about a couple of months.
Yeah.
I had no idea what I was going to do.
Right.
I was actually a really good military. I was a good platoon leader.
It sounds like it.
I was really good at it. Yeah. And I felt like I was just getting ready to leave the best job or the job I was ever going to be that good at.
I mean, you could have continued.
I could have.
Right.
But, you know, Margo really wanted me to come home. When I enlisted, I did it with the idea of being just like my uncles and my dad and my great-grandparents. You know, you enlist, you fight your war, and then you come home.
Win the war and then...
Yeah. But literally, I remember calling mom and saying, hey, I'm home. Don't have to worry about me. Margo and I are taking a trip to Ireland.
Right.
And so before I ever went home to Ohio, we went to Ireland first.
That's nice. Was it hard to come back into civilian life? And I mean, how long did it take to get divorced?
It's kind of funny you say that. So did the block leave, came back. All of us got promoted to captain. The breaking up started happening for the unit.
Right.
If some guys were staying, some were going on.
Right. But you've been with these guys for how long at this point?
3 years almost. And so there was this sense, it really felt like a family breaking up.
Yeah.
And so, and it really, there really wasn't much in the way of transition programming back in 2006. It was literally just check off this sheet to make sure you've turned all the Army's property in and good luck.
How much more is there now? Do you know?
There's a lot more. Like there's a lot of mandatory courses you have to do.
Crazy it took that long for them to like realize that this is probably a real traumatic experience for people.
That's been probably the only good thing to come out of the fact that we fought a war for basically 25 years was the systems that needed to be, that probably always should have been in place to help aid that transition.
Right.
Started to get built and are likely to be sustained in the future.
Hopefully,
so,
although, they're talking about cutting.
We'll see. Right. I've always warned people when it comes to guns and butters, the Pentagon's always going to have to choose guns.
Sure, and I heard they're cutting tons of people from the VA,
If I would have to say I had a low point in my life, it would be that period between getting out, which was like 2006,
right,
through 2007. I felt a lot of pressure to get a job. I didn't know what I wanted to do.
Sure.
I went to some interviews that I didn't really enjoy very much. I mean, it's not like I was an idiot before I left for the Army. No, I was right. doing human resources right. policy, administrative code rules.
But there's got to be a preconceived idea of what a person coming right. out of the military is to come into a job.
And right.
it's got to be a thing. You've right. got to, yeah, interesting.
And I would say also to that experience, there was a lot of pressure from my wife at the time to get work. She saw it as like, at least my perception was, we're turning the page on this military life you had and getting back to the life we had pre 9/11.
Oh, I see.
Which was never going to happen for me.
Right, right.
And so, and I think because she was so close to me during that time, she didn't see the change.
Or plus she was so used to having you outside of the house that maybe she's just right. like, cool.
Well, and that's what we talked about was like at the end of the day, we were always saying hello or goodbye.
Right.
And so we never really had a chance to get on each other's nerves.
Maybe that's how the relationship could have yeah. worked if you just stayed and, further apart. Right.
And so actually by early 2007, we were separated.
Okay.
And I was living back with my mom and dad in West Jefferson, which was not an ideal situation.
It never is.
And, yeah. And I was, now by this time I did get a job with the state. Is why I always tell young people do internships, because the woman that hired me as an intern, who then hired me as a full-time analyst for the state as a human resource policy person, I don't know how, but somehow my resume came across her desk.
Right.
And she goes, oh, Danny's back. Right. And she goes to a guy and she goes, hire him and I don't care where.
Oh.
And it's an intermittent job.
Right.
Executive assistant, basically, still, for a yeah. guy. But I was happy to do it. And it led to the conditions that allowed me to actually draw straight line to the job I have now that I've had for like 15 years. So.
Yeah. It's always yeah. when I've like talked to film students about what work's going to be like, I'm just like, your goal is to meet people. That's
yeah.
it. Right.
Yeah.
Because that's where you get the work. I don't know if that's similar to your situation.
No, I think it is. Cause I mean, at the end of the day, when I got the chance to work in the veteran community, I got that chance because I had been in the military.
Right.
But the other reason I had the chance was because the people that were making the hiring decisions, or at least making recommendations, were the people I had already worked for when I was right. a civilian.
When did you get into the job with the veterans?
That was actually one of the positive things that happened. So I'm separated for a year, alcohol, you know.
Okay.
A lot of self-destructive behavior.
Was there a low point?
There was. I remember one night going out drinking. I think I started downtown. I go drinking up towards like Dublin, you know, sure. some of those strip yeah. mall bars.
We'll
up
put
there.
A map in the show notes.
And so I remember driving back out to West Jeff, having to like pull over behind a different strip mall so I wouldn't be seen from the road and like falling asleep.
Wow.
And yeah. not going to work the next day.
Yeah.
And deciding then that maybe it's time for me to see about a couple of things. One is counseling.
Right.
And maybe get back with Margot. The other thing I decided within that framework was to join the National Guard. I thought that would be a good way to put one foot back in. And it turned out that was true. I would say joining the National Guard ended up being critical. I also ended up with the confidence to go apply for a new job, as it just so happened that my first job doing veteran stuff was actually for higher education. And it just so happened that the woman who had been my boss when I left for the military, she, by that time, was the governor's deputy legal counsel, found out I was available and looking for work, and recommended me to Patrick McClain.
It's all who you know. It's all about
me.
Connections. Yeah. Yeah.
And that job led directly to what I'm... A year after doing that, I was asked to come over to the Department of Veterans Service to do policy and program development there.
So did you get back with your wife?
So, yeah. So we actually did get back. I moved back in. We started doing marriage counseling, which... At first was a disaster because it wasn't so much like, hey, let's fix our marriage. I would be taken to a counselor and it'd be like, fix them.
And she would say that to the counselor?
That was essentially what her perception of counseling was.
Oh, that's helpful.
And yeah. My thing was, go fuck yourself.
Oh, like, so that worked out.
And now that said, though, that ended up with me being introduced to the person who I still see today on a monthly basis for counseling.
Oh.
He helped with the marriage a little bit. At the end of the day, I got to a spot, though, personally, where I realized the marriage just wasn't.
Yeah, I feel like when you start going to relationship counseling, it's already over.
There were just things, though, I started to learn about myself that I knew would make it untenable. Right. And so essentially, you know, ended up getting divorced anyway. And that's why I say, like, out of that kind of low point, I joined the Guard. Therapy became a thing, which still, and it, when I look at the work I do now to, you know, try to help prevent veteran and military suicide and
right.
understand the struggles and, you know, a lot of what I do is not just the crisis systems, but I'm always pushing and advocating for the upstream things. We know, you know, it's financial distress, it's yep. relationship distress. It's yep. those things that really get people to crisis. And so having that understanding and all because I would never have it if I hadn't gone through it. And to be honest, it gives me a level of, for lack of a better term, credibility when I talk about
sure.
it. No, I mean, not least of all, I thought I'd be dead by now, right? I assumed I'd get killed overseas. Yeah. So I remember thinking that unhappy face of mine at the hangar at Fort Riley after we got home was the, I can't believe now I have to deal with all this shit.
I didn't think I'd have to.
Right. I thought I'd be dead.
Right.
Like I'd be a memorial somewhere and,
right.
you know,
right.
and not have to worry about it all. But now I do. And now I think about, you know, you fast forward several years meeting Sarah and becoming a stepdad.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Meeting people like yourself and the great group of guys that, you know, we've got here and get together. And I think of all those things that I might have missed.
For sure.
From that.
For sure.
And
every day is a gift, right?
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
I don't know, for lack of a better word, were you like harder when you were younger, like when the military? Do you feel like you've softened or do you feel like...
I feel like I've softened.
Right.
I was definitely more emotional. One of the things my therapist has worked with me on, I think between therapy and age, is learning how not to react to things. I remember even before my mom passed away, I remember my therapist, he wrote something up on, you know, he had a chalkboard.
Yeah.
And he wrote something up on it. He goes, I want you to put this in your phone. And it was reduce your reactivity today. So when you're in traffic, whatever you're doing, don't react to this.
It's hard, especially in the fucking traffic.
Absolutely.
Too. That's my weak spot is absolutely, the fucking traffic.
Same. I cannot. And that's why I lived downtown for years. So I walked to work.
Everybody's the worst driver except for me.
Exactly. Precisely. And I can tell you that if you would look up my phone today, every morning at 7 a.m., a reminder comes up, says reduce your reactivity. And I leave it on, you know, like the page so that I see it all day. I don't swipe that off my page until I get home at night. So that every time it pulls up in the car, wherever it is, reduce your reactivity today. It's like a constant reminder.
Right, right, right. The trick really is separating yourself from your thoughts and realizing that you're not your thoughts, that your thoughts are actually just, you know, your consciousness firing itself, doing what it does, and being able to separate yourself and give yourself a little space between that and you is profoundly helpful in almost every situation. And a skill that most people just never even consider having or don't. Maybe they do, but I just feel like a lot of people don't.
I think our culture tries to force people into buckets, identities.
Well, sure. Especially
we define ourselves not so much by ourselves. We define ourselves insofar as our relationship with the rest of the planet. That's an outside in definition.
Yeah.
Whereas we should try to define ourselves from the inside out. I think there's a pressure within our society to say, I'm this way, this is my identity, blah, blah, blah. And I struggle with that quite a bit still. Right. What I've learned though, and what I liked about the concept of duality is that you can be all those things at once. I can be someone who has taken someone else's life, be someone who finds other people's lives precious, and also be someone that gets so pissed off sometimes, I just wish I could, you know.
Of course.
You know, people talk about, I just want to run through, like, you know, I just want to really throttle that guy.
Right.
Right. You can be all those things, and it's okay. You don't have to be a monk. You don't have to be this or that. I just feel like there's so much pressure on people to try to say, define yourself, and it can only be this, and you can't be this, and you can't be this. Like,
right.
No, you can be all those things. Humans are highly complex.
The struggle to make yourself a certain thing is ruining you for the other things that you could possibly be.
Exactly. What are you missing out on because you're telling yourself? And I guess that's one of the things I started to learn. I remember when I met Sarah, I'd gotten to a point in my life, things were good, right? I'm doing good psychologically. I'm getting therapy. I've got a job I love.
Right.
It was challenging with some of the leadership and all that.
Sure.
Always. But at the end of the day, I really knew I'm a lucky person. But there was still, I still found myself saying, you're this, I had been a soldier, and that is an identity.
Right.
It is your life.
Very
it
clear
is your culture.
One. Yeah.
But I had to find this new me, the me that wasn't Margot's husband.
Right.
And that wasn't my mom and dad's son.
Right.
That was this new guy that had come back from all this, still fundamentally the same person, but clearly changed, and where I could be comfortable with it. And I feel like I had just gotten there kind of when my mom passed away.
Mm-hmm.
My dad and I have always been close from the standpoint of like, my dad's kind of like my buddy.
Mm-hmm.
My mom was always the shoulder.
Sure.
The person I talked with deeply sure. about things, and just being part of that process for her of essentially the week where she got sick and being with her when she died and going through that and understanding how I could make space for other people. And it put me in the space. And it's no secret to me that a month after my mom died is when I met Sarah.
Huh.
And I had decided finally after mom died that why don't I date moms? And it wasn't because I had a problem with kids. It was because
it's gonna be the name of this episode yeah. is going to be Why Don't I Date Moms?
Yeah. I drink, I cuss. I was in the military. Like I've got this lifestyle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's not one that moms want around their kids.
Sure.
But yeah. then I realized, I was like, why are you doing that to your, no mom has told you that.
Right.
Why are you doing that to yourself?
Right.
And I kind of joked that I went into Costanza mode, you know, from Seinfeld where right. he does the opposite of everything he usually does and things go better for him.
I mean, that's a great plan, really.
Yeah. And right. literally within a month I met Sarah.
Right.
And she herself, and frankly, everyone I've met through her, like just different ways of thinking, a different type of relationship than I've ever had in my lifetime. I had defined myself to such a point I was preventing myself from, as it turns out, thankfully in time, to be, you know, with the love of my life. Right.
Right. But, right. Well, so, it's getting out of your comfort zone is the thing. I mean,
exactly.
In many ways, it's saying, yeah. it's saying to yourself that, you know, this is not a thing I would normally do, but if I do it, this is all, in my experience, it's where all the good stuff happens. Right.
Yes.
And it's weird how life kind of unfolds for you sometimes, you know.
It's incredible.
How has your perspective on the military changed, I guess, over the years? Because you've been dealing with military stuff for the last 23.
You know, there's the institution and then there's the people.
Sure. Okay. And, I guess I'm talking about, the institution more than the
yeah,
people.
I mean, I generally think they're a positive force. There's no other organization or career in the United States that brings people from those types of diverse backgrounds, socioeconomic statuses. It's where, if you're paying attention, and that's what I always used to tell my guys, I was like, pay attention while you're here. You're getting the opportunity to see and do things and meet people that most people you ever interact with will never have a chance
for
to
sure.
do. And it's telling that how stable our society was, relatively speaking, amongst that World War II generation who had experienced all that from all walks of life. They'd always talk about with the British. There's a reason why after World War I, all those social class distinctions started to go away.
Huh.
So that they barely existed World War II.
Yeah.
And it was because they had all served together. And so now all of a sudden, the gentleman officer who had been the captain in the trenches
right.
with the uneducated, so
we're
supposedly,
friends. We know each other, right?
You know, served, they found out what real sacrifice and real
right.
brotherhood was, chewing dirt together, experiencing the thing they did together. And it turned out all those other things, when it came to first, second order right, effects, right. didn't matter. And I still think that what we're seeing in our society more broadly is, we all grew up in a world where our grandparents had all served during World War II or lived during that period. And so they either saw or experienced the entire, no matter what you do, no matter what I do, you were in the Marines, I was in the Army, we all did something. And so there's a level of respect across socioeconomic statuses and jobs.
Right.
So even if you were the CEO or the worker, you both served. And so there's that commonality. And I think that sustained us for some time. I don't think it sustained us as long as people think it did. I think it started to fall apart relatively quickly.
Right.
But I think we're starting to see with that generation on the way out, we're starting to see in our society, the kind of the chaos, that relative chaos that, you know, you start to see the polarization and very different worldviews of what.
Right.
What the
I
the
feel
planet
like every
is.
50 years or so we get things like this. It's a global thing too.
Absolutely. Kind of like, and it's technology driven too, right?
Right. I mean, now it is for sure. I mean, I think I wonder if this one's going to end or how it will end, because I feel like it's almost, we've gone beyond the, you know, beyond, not the paradigm, but something else. But anyway,
yeah.
But like we've gone beyond that, and I'm not sure how we turn back from.
I don't know if we can.
Rubicon.
Yeah.
Brain.
I always used to use the example that if you were a Roman who lived 50 years before the birth of Christ, your life was not appreciably different from someone who lived 200 years later or 50 years after the birth of Christ. Sure,
because technology wasn't...
Politics was all fairly constant. It's
a straight line for a long time, and then it goes straight up.
Right. And even then, there were still disruptions in society and culture and stuff, right? And when those happened, they were catastrophic because people just don't have the intellectual wherewithal to change that quickly, right? We're not designed... Right. Evolution doesn't work that way. Whereas now we've entered a technological period where, you know, look how different the world is today from what it was 10 years ago compared to 20 years ago.
Or a year ago.
To 100 years ago. A year ago.
I mean, honestly, it's going too fast for humans to keep up with, and our brains are breaking.
And,
I also like, it's also like we're an evolutionarily like designed to understand like the tribe, like 80 people or something, right? That's about what we're able to keep track of. And now it's the whole world we can literally keep track of. And I don't think that we can do that. And I think that this is why we're seeing systemic collapse in so many different places, right?
It was interesting to me. One of the things I took away from overseas as well, I thought about how, you know, in the last 70 years in America, in the West, we adopted the sense of the nuclear family, right? You have, you live in a house and then you live in a house. In Iraq and some of those societies, it's still very communal. Like you might have a house on the corner, but the relatives live upstairs and the cousins live over here. And you'd get into one house and you would go an entire city block in one building.
Well, it's like America was 100 years ago.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think that's a big part of what's wrong in a way too. We really lost community. And I think that is really a shame. Like, I don't really know my neighbors very well. And I don't think this is uncommon. And I think that this is bad, you know?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I think it was compounded by the pandemic.
For sure.
Yeah. I think about how when we moved in kind of when it was still, you know, working at home and not too many businesses open and stuff. And so we kind of missed on the opportunity to meet our neighbors. And that's one of the things I was really looking forward to. I remember when I first came back from the military, we actually bought a house in Bexley. And we did get to know, like, my neighbor, his name was Duff, was his nickname. And I remember the people saying, hey, he's got a key to the house, if that's okay, because he's super helpful. And, you know, we trust, and we were like, yes, please hold on to it. Right. And I just met the guy.
Right.
And he ended up being amazing. Like, he'd be the kind of guy like, hey, Duff, I'm at work. I forgot to do this thing. Could you check this? And he'd go over and do it. And he'd be like, oh, I checked this too, by the way. This needs fixed. I was able to do this. You're going to have to get this. I'm willing to do it for you if you go get the parts, that kind of thing.
Right.
Just great guy.
Because he's learned that the key to happiness is actually not about you. It's about helping other people.
You know, I've got 9 years left with the state before I can retire with 32 years. And the more and more I get closer to it, the more I think I want to do local things.
Sure.
You know, just here in our community.
Yeah.
You know, people who are distressed about elections and things like that. I had a friend from Chicago about 8-9 years ago. She randomly started texting me about political things for the first time ever.
Right.
And so we've kind of kept a, you know, just friendly banter from time to time going. And she was in real distress after the last election.
A lot of people were.
Yeah. And I said, you know, there's not a whole lot you can do about that. That is what it is. I said, but what you can do is get involved in your community.
Right. It'll make you feel better. Somewhere to put that energy.
Exactly. Because, and so when she texted me, I want to say more recently, she had started working with a group that helps support the needs of Ukrainian refugees in the Chicagoland area, you know? And I was like, you know, that's great, you know, because that's where, you know, that matters. You're making real differences in people's lives.
For sure.
And you didn't have to vote. You didn't have to join a party. You didn't have to do all this other stuff. You just had to do something in your community. And that will make all the difference in the world.
The level of anxiety and anger that I was feeling from a lot of my people that I, acquaintances and friends and so forth, was kind of over the top. That's them winning, right? Your energy and your attention being focused so strongly on your anger, that is what they want. That is how they win, right? This is the goal, really. And it's not going to change a fucking thing. your anxiety is not going to make Trump not the president anymore.
Yes.
I mean, certainly I'm concerned, but like manifesting this anger and fear about what's going on in the world is really just a useless. And like you said, I think putting it to use and taking that anger and that energy and putting it to actual positive use in the community is probably the best thing you could probably do.
Yeah.
Probably better than calling your congressperson because they don't give a shit anymore.
And that's part of the technology thing too, right? Is that like it's created a level of separation between what people say, what gets you animated, and what you actually do. Because right. doing is hard.
Right.
It requires time. You have to get away.
You have to get out of your comfort zone.
Yeah, you have to get out of your comfort zone. You have to break off. You know, you can't be doom scrolling and things like that. I will say that's one of the things too. Like I basically, about the only social media I've left is I have LinkedIn for professional reasons. And last year, Sarah got me to sign on to Reddit just to, because it is useful Reddit's for knowing what's one. Going on it's in the neighborhood. Best one.
Yeah,
I love being able to just get on there, the Columbus subreddit, and be like, dude, oh, this is what's going on around town.
I enjoy the Columbus subreddit, but Jesus Christ, dude, can we just stop with all the posts about how bad the drivers are? Like every fucking day.
I will say before I had that subreddit, I had no idea that running cars into buildings was a thing.
Oh, yeah, that was definitely a thing. Yeah, thing. You know, the Columbus subreddit is one of the most popular city-based subreddits on Reddit.
Is it? Really? Really? I had no idea. One of the
most active, yeah.
Yeah.
Which doesn't surprise me because you look at that thing and there's a wide, yeah, it's a bit much. Few little other questions I wanted to get to before we...
Sure.
What do you think the military looks like in 50 years, if you can speculate? And beyond that, like, this is, I guess, a separate question, but like, do you feel like the government is using the military in a way that respects the lives of the people that choose to join the military?
I think that's always going to be a tough one. It's funny, even though you said their two questions are almost linked, because the future of warfare is going to be
right.
remote.
This is what I was...
It will be...
robots fighting robots.
Robots fighting, well, or our robots fighting their...
For a period of time, and then eventually...
Yeah, yeah. We'll burn through those munitions. Right.
Our robots just completely annihilating.
But as we've also seen, though, is that, like, you know, you see in Ukraine, I mean, you just need a bunch of young people in a warehouse putting crap together to make a fleet of low-cost drones.
Yeah.
So I think that will play a part in it. I have not seen in my experience around the military and around military people just the kind of just blatant disregard for casualties that you might have seen, like, let's say World War I, World War II, you know, Civil War.
Right, but the weapons have also gotten...
The weapons have gotten different, but there's also, I'd say you started to see it a little bit in World War II, maybe a little bit more, the attitude that we want you to go fight, we want you to come home. We're not going to be throwing away lives. When you look at our tactics, when you look at our equipment, our armored vehicles, they're not designed to be indestructible, but they are designed to be survivable.
Right.
And that's one thing you're seeing over in Ukraine right now. A Russian tank, when it explodes, kills everybody inside it.
Right.
When it gets hit by ammunition. When some of the Western kit that the Ukrainians are using, when it gets hit, it's disabled, but a lot of times the crew survives. There are deliberate parts of the M1 tank and Allied tanks that are designed fundamentally differently from the way the Soviets designed stuff because we value the lives of the occupants.
Sure. But I mean, you look at Vietnam and that seems to be a very clear example of the United States, like information coming out after the fact that suggested the United States was perhaps not valuing and forcing people to go to a war that we knew we couldn't win.
One thing I think that was always frustrating about Vietnam would be, and quite frankly, this is what we ended up having in our current wars. We don't have like a clear strategic objective. There's no taking the capital and no surrender. There's no Versailles. There's no ceremony on the battleship Missouri. There's
build more weapons and keep the military thing. I mean,
yeah. I mean, the reality is too, in our modern society, the United States has real security obligations to the rest of the planet. And if you look at it, especially since the Second World War, the period of American military, you know, at first parity with the Soviets, kind of, but literally it has in a lot of ways, especially in retrospect, been a period of American military supremacy, has been the period in world history with the most technological advancement, the most advancement for most people in terms of human rights, in terms of fully appreciating the full gamut of what human beings can and be and who they
are. I mean,
are.
Do you attribute that? I mean, I'm not sure if I make the correlation necessarily, but...
I don't think where we are today is the natural progression of history. It was a deliberate effort that if not for us, I mean, what does the world look like if either fascism or communism from the mid-20th century prevails? And it's not the world that's around us today. You know what else isn't happening anymore? There's not literally millions of people dying from certain types of preventable diseases.
Oh, sure. No, I mean, for sure. I wouldn't. Things are better now than they've ever been in the history of the world, for sure.
And that's not an inevitability. And, you know, we're not the inevitable result of global history. We're in a place because we're fortunate that a handful of pilots at the Battle of Midway get through a screen and managed to destroy four Japanese carriers, right? Instead of our carriers being sunk. It's literally these little moments throughout history of where decisions are made, things break our way. And because of it, we live in a different world than we might otherwise have lived in.
For sure. But there was no way of knowing whether the world we might've lived in would be necessarily worse. I mean, we can argue that it would be.
Well,
we can
I would argue if the fascists would have won World War II, it would have been worse.
That's a clear one. But I'm saying, like, you know, we lost Vietnam, and that was a big one where they said that this is catastrophic, but it really didn't end up being all that catastrophic.
It was never going to decide the fate of nations.
Right, right. So, I mean, I hear what you're saying. I would say, yes, the United States has been a great force for good in the world, but if the United States hadn't ended up being the world superpower, I don't know. In some ways, I feel like our lives might actually be better because I think the result of America being a superpower, and I think that the thing that's being reckoned with now is why are we spending so much time helping the other countries when our country is fucked, right? When people in our country are starving and we're cutting Medicaid and Medicare and we can barely pay our, you know.
Perfectly legitimate perspective. Yeah.
And I think this has been coming for a while. And I believe we're slowly coming to the end of the age of American dominance of the world. I think China's ready to step in.
I think China's got its own problems. They've got population issues.
Of course they've got problems.
They've got economic dislocations. They've got, and here's the thing too.
They're also getting things done though.
Yeah, they do. They're a lot better.
I mean, made things. America's lost the ability to make things.
Right.
We talk a lot. We pass all these bills, but what happens?
Right.
I mean, where's Build Back Better?
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, I don't disagree. I mean, they talk about how
China's built high speed rail all over that country in the last 10-15 years. It's incredible.
Here's the thing, too. You're still not allowed to, if you live in the country in China, you're not allowed to move to the city.
Is that right?
Unless they approve it.
Oh well, communism, right?
Yeah, and so. They have a very large middle class. They still have like hundreds of millions of people that live in poverty and like damn near starvation. But they've got big gleaming cities and they're able to control information in the country. And again, this isn't to say one's better than the other. It's just to say like what we're also seeing in today's world is like the moment the US begins to retreat, it's just like I used to, you know, I told you we used to talk about with the Iraqis. Nobody's particularly thrilled with the situation, but everybody kind of understands why we're here and why we're doing this. And I've been old enough to see the swings. Nobody wants America in their business until all of a sudden America decides to pull back from the world and the rest of the world panics. You know, we see it now, right? The tension in Europe about defense spending.
Mm-hmm.
Did they freeload on American defense? Sure did.
A little bit, yeah.
Are they able to maintain certain levels of public support for some of their systems because they're not investing in their defense systems the same way the US is? Absolutely.
Yep.
They're now being forced to make some pretty tough choices because whether by design or accident, the US doesn't seem as a reliable partner as it used to be. So now you have Germany going from less than 2% GDP on defense to talking about getting to 5% perhaps at one point.
Yep.
Deploying, you know, troops into other parts of Europe, particularly in Western Europe, the East Central European countries have always been, you know, they having been most recently under foreign occupation, they kind of understand the dangers. But
I think it was a lot easier for America to be the, you know, policeman of the world when our country was flourishing, you know. When our country was doing well. And I think when you get to see more and more problems going on in America, then it becomes more of a question of like, well, what are we doing with all, you know?
You know, I grew up, you know, my dad got laid off in Timken. I know what it's like to eat government cheese and government bread from the National Labor Relations Board.
What kind of
board.
Cheese is that? A cheese? Is it a cheddar? Or
it's been, I think it's, I always like thought it was American? Like Velveeta. It's like American cheese. Right. Yeah.
So like cheese food.
Yeah, just like the orange block.
Yeah, yeah.
There's real economic distress. There's real questions about how you pay for medical care.
Absolutely.
How you pay for this.
Absolutely.
And they do see a lot of, you know, waste. And there is a lot, and a lot, some things
corruption,
are fake.
They see all this, right? Elites taking over.
Exactly.
You know, they see all of it.
I mean, we're in a state that has a former speaker in prison.
This
right?
is where I get mad with this, like, Trump supporters are all fucking morons narrative. Because, like, if you make less than 50 grand in this country, you're fucked. Like, it's right. not, it's not going well for these people. And Trump, you know, he's a pull of shit, but he said, I'm going to help you people. And,
right.
you know, the Democrats said, oh, it's the economy's doing great.
And that gets to be a product that goes back to that identity thing we talked about.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, if you identify with just this, and this is all you know, and these are the only people you hang out with,
yeah,
you're never going to know that. But that's what it gets back to, like, you know, what does the military do? The military brings people with college educations.
Different, yeah. Different
high
backgrounds.
School diplomas. Different socioeconomic statuses, brings them all into the same place. You're going to be sharing spaces with people of different perspectives. You're going to have those moments to talk about what life was like growing up in that world.
Huh. I wonder if there's a way we can do that without the killing part.
Well, that's why you, you know what I mean? You hear a lot of people, like, and I hear it both people who are left, right, center. They talk about national service programs.
Yeah.
You know, I go back and forth. You know, at the soul, I'm still kind of an individual rights libertarian type. I've never been huge on the idea of compulsory service, but I also am big on national social cohesion because I understand that I've seen a country devolve from even a country with as strong communities as they have in a place like Iraq devolves into the level of interpersonal, internecine violence and what it looks like.
Yeah, but I mean, the Middle East was carved up by, I mean, you can go to a whole other thing, but nature of the Middle East.
At the end of the day, there's nothing more personal than a guy driving over across the city just to blow you up.
True.
Right. And that has nothing to do with the Brits or anything else. That's just what's happening right then.
Right.
And so I know what a lack of national cohesion, the vacuum of authority, power, and cohesion looks like, and it's not pretty. The whole reason we have government systems, right, is because it was an improvement over just going to war with each other every time we disagreed about something, mm-hmm. right, in human evolution. It was better to talk about things than to fight over them. We've gotten to the point, though, people with legitimate grievances are no longer talking to each other or listening.
No.
More importantly, they're not listening.
Yeah.
And they're talking past each other.
And the politicians are making a show of it.
Well, here's the other thing. If you're CNN or a media company, even traditional media,
it's a kleptocracy.
Do you make more money off the story about
it's
a group of people getting together
for sure
to fix a problem, or do you get more money off the thing that generates the anger clicks?
No, I mean, I don't want to get too cynical, but like, I think that the money is ruining our entire country, and we have a government that's been completely taken over by bribes, by legal bribes at this point. And I don't see that you're ever going to be able to fix that because the system will not fix itself from within. If I was to run for office, say on a platform of like getting all the money out of politics, I'm not going to raise any fucking money because the person and the candidate with the most money 98% of the time, I think, wins. So like, how do you even break through that barrier to even try to change the system in the most fundamental way that it needs to be changed in my mind?
I don't think it's cynical to say that just objectively looking at where we are as a country and as a planet, that it's hard to see how we get to the next thing without some form of global catastrophe.
Right. And I don't want to live through that.
Right.
But I think that that's what, I mean, what revolution or something to this effect, or a class warfare against the billionaires. I just don't know how it, I mean, they're already buying bunkers and shit in fucking Hawaii.
And I guess that's the thing that is, these things historically seem to create their own inertia,
mm-hmm.
right? So people say they're doing certain things to prevent something, but the mere fact that everyone's got that mindset ends up leading to certain types of decisions being made. The Guns of August, right? World War I.
Right.
everybody thinks they understand what's going on and they're preparing things to deter aggression or to deter that person, this or that. But at the end of the day, it's because everybody gets so tuned up and they have so much, they think they've got so much information. They think they know exactly what's going on around, but they're actually making the wrong decisions and they're talking. And again, they're not listening. They're talking past each other. And you end up with a situation where everybody misunderstands everybody's intention. The entire planet goes to war.
Well, when the information, hooray. Well, when the information is being controlled by a handful of 7 or 8 people, like the, what 90% of information is being controlled by most of the people that were at Trump's inauguration, actually, which is literally impossible, like insane to really think about. It seems like the entire thing is becoming more and more and more rigged. And I don't know. I don't know how it's going to play out. I could honestly sit here and talk to you for hours, but I got to edit this fucking thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Sorry. We've gone all over.
No, it's totally fine. Last question I always ask generally, what do you think happens when we die?
I tend to be a pretty humanist. I was fully prepared for the concept that when I died, that would be it. I wouldn't be meeting anybody. I wouldn't be seeing my dead relatives or anything like that. It would just be, I'm here and then I'm gone. If you catch me in my more reflective moments, which I suppose this would be one of them, I can't get away from the fact that there's got to be whatever this divine spark is.
Consciousness.
Got us to where we are. There's got to be something to it.
Yeah.
I'm now married to someone who's caused me to open my mind more to the spiritual.
And isn't that the best thing?
And,
right?
Yeah. And I can understand why it provides comfort. I also can kind of see its practical effects. When she tells me that between my mom and her grandmother, like we kind of manifested each other, you know, that kind of thing. I get it. I feel it on some level.
Mm-hmm.
So it must be real. And so I would say if you'd have caught me a decade ago and you asked me what happens when I die, you clean me up and you put me in the ground.
Sure.
Now I probably have a bit more of a sense that this isn't the end. It's just transition.
Yeah, it's a tough line to walk. I've always kind of been swinging towards that. Well, we don't know what happens to consciousness, maybe. But like, it really does go against my logical self, you know? Mm-hmm. And you start to ask and you start to say, well, if we don't have any science to prove these things, how do we? But if you feel it, maybe, I don't know.
Remember we talked about duality.
Yeah.
I can hold both things in my head at the same time.
Right. And hope for the best.
Yeah.
Right. Danny Akins, thanks so much for coming on, dude. This was a fascinating conversation. I really appreciate you.
Me too, man. I love this.
Yeah, dude. Appreciate you as a friend. Appreciate you coming on.
You too, brother.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
That was Danny Akins talking about an experience that I don't think many of us have ever had or will ever have. I'm extremely grateful to Danny for sharing all of that in such a candid way, and also for patiently waiting 2 months for this episode to be released. I have a backlog, you see. And as always and forever, please like, subscribe, rate, and review on whatever platform you're listening to this on. On Spotify, it's a little tricky, but you can do it. I believe in you. Do it now, before you forget. I'll wait. Thank you for doing that. And please email me anything you want at 1fjeffpod@gmail.com. Tell me what you thought of this episode. Ask me what I had for breakfast. Give me tips for my impending road trip across the United States. I'm leaving tomorrow morning, so you better hurry. I will be documenting my trip as I take it on here. So if you'd like to live vicariously through me as I travel, you should turn on your notifications because I will probably be releasing things whenever the mood strikes me. And you need to be ready. If you enjoyed this episode, which I hope you did, please pass it along to somebody else who might also enjoy it. Because spreading enjoyment is a good thing. Unless it's with fentanyl. I am truly grateful for you and your ears for listening to this. And I will not stop thanking you. so you better just get used to it. There's no such thing as too much gratitude, at least when it's sincere. And I promise you, this is that. So, thank you for listening. Thank you for being here. I'll see you on the road.
Jeff, every word well laid. Very good, Jeffrey.